This is a restart of an article I started my last recording time from the National Geographic magazine. April 2026. Title of the... I'll start again. This is Paul, and I'll be reading from the National Geographic April 2026 article, magazine. The article title is Lost and Found. More than 1,000 years ago, after a ship vanished off the coast of modern-day Croatia, an archaeological dive team uncovered a wreck loaded with a trove of Byzantine artifacts, as well as some puzzling questions that might reshape our ideas of the medieval world. By Rolf Smith. It was the site of a large bronze medieval cauldron lying on the seabed among some of the moldering old ship timbers that first piqued Igor Mihojek's interest. Then head of the Department for Underwater Archaeology at the Croatian Conservation Institute, the state agency that looks after the nation's cultural resources, Mihojek ran a small team that in 2014 had been diving around some recently identified shipwrecks. This particular vessel had gone down off the coast of Miljek, one of Croatia's southernmost Adriatic islands, and he wanted to see if there were any clues that might be worth further investigation. The wreck itself wasn't exactly a surprising discovery. Miljek lies along one of antiquity's main east-west sea trade routes, connecting Italian hubs like Ravenna and Venice with Constantinople, now Istanbul, and points east. Over the years, archaeological surveys of the seabed around the picturesque island, with its Roman ruins and the ancient harbor of Polace at its western tip, had yielded more than 24 old wrecks, ranging from the remains of a Roman ship from the 2nd century BC to that of a 16th century AD Venetian merchantman laden with rare Ottoman ceramics. But even in an area relatively littered with historical wrecks, something about the cauldron told Mihojek that this was one different from the others. The presence of the old cauldron, together with the scatter of amphorae, large two-handled pots used since antiquity for transporting wine and olive oil, lying around it suggested that the lost vessel was a Byzantine ship, which would be an extremely rare find in the Adriatic Sea. During his decades-long career, Mihojek and his team had found only one other Byzantine wreck, also off of Miljek, but that one had dated from the 11th century AD. Judging by the shapes and styles of the amphorae he saw on the bottom, this latest discovery was much older, possibly from the late 7th or early 8th century, part of an intriguing period historians used to refer to as the Dark Ages, when the fortunes of a Byzantine empire were at a low point, and when some historians believe that the Adriatic was an impoverished backwater, virtually devoid of shipping. Yet here was a Byzantine cargo ship lying on the seabed, some 130 feet below the surface. The prospect of excavating the submerged relic was, quote, too good an opportunity to pass up, end quote, Mihojek says, recalling his initial excitement. Today, after a decade of painstaking progress, Mihojek and his team have uncovered something more astonishing than they could ever imagine. A rich trove of artifacts that has not only opened a valuable window into travel and trade in the Adriatic at a time when written records were nearly blank, but also revealed a glittering golden mystery. Beyond the predictable objects like anchors and cooking implements, the team recovered a collection of exquisite masculine jewelry. Gold buckles, pendants, belt strap ends, and a gold signet ring they believed bears the likeness of Emperor Heraclius, who ruled Byzantium from 610 to 641, a collection that appears to have been the property of a wealthy and well-connected person aboard the ship. Who was he? Where was he headed, and for what purpose? The search to answer such tantalizing questions is beginning to give historians a glimpse into an empire facing tumultuous times. Quote, whatever was going on here, this was no normal trading venture, end quote, Mihalik says. Whatever that mission was, the people conducting it never got beyond Miljek before disaster overtook them, perhaps in the form of a local weather phenomenon known as the Bora. A katabatic wind that forms in the mountains running along the stretch of coast, the Bora can strike with little warning, roaring down the mountainsides like an avalanche of dense cold air. Within minutes, it can turn a calm sea into a maelstrom of heaving waves and hurricane-force gusts. Judging by the position of the wreck, Mihaljek believes the captain was trying to reach the sheltered harbor of Polachi when his ship was overwhelmed. Jump forward to a sunny summer day in the 21st century, and it's hard to imagine Mihaljek at the sea as a scene of so much tragedy and loss. With its blue waters and unspoiled landscapes, it's widely considered one of the world's most beautiful islands. While the fickle Bora wind slowly contributed to the collection of shipwrecks throughout the region, the wreckage has been left undisturbed by a quirk of Iron Curtain elitism. For much of the 20th century, Mihaljek was largely reserved for the use of the Yugoslav military, which meant the wrecks could not be picked over by sport divers, at least not civilian ones. After the breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s, Mihaljek became a protected archaeological zone. Quote, it's a paradise for underwater archaeologists, end quote, Mihaljek says. Despite the potential trove of underwater evidence, excavating the Byzantine wreck was not for the faint of heart. The ship's remains lay scattered over a steep and rocky seabed at a depth that required the archaeologists to move carefully during each extremely limited dive. For safety reasons, divers could spend just over a half an hour a day at the site. What's more, being short on funds, the team could afford to visit the wreck for only a couple of weeks each summer. This meant that the typically exacting process of underwater archaeology, carefully scanning the area with metal detectors, excavating items from the silt, plotting objects on a grid, and building a 3D map of the site, took even longer than normal. At first, Mihaljek might have expected to unearth the workaday world of an early medieval coastal trader hauling olive oil, wine, and fish sauce from port to port up the Dalmatian coast. But during their third season of diving, the team turned up something that flipped the narrative on its head. On a morning descent near one of the deeper parts of the site, landmarked by a couple of anchors poised on the edge of a steep drop-off, underwater archaeologist Pavel Dugonjic noticed a curious shape in the sand. Sweeping away the silt with his hand, he stared, spellbound, through his mask. It was an exquisitely crafted golden buckle, intricately decorated with birds pecking at grapes from a cornucopia. Quote, I've found many beautiful artifacts in the course of my career, end quote, Dugonjic says. Quote, but never anything like this, end quote. After logging the find on his dive slate, an underwater notepad, and recording its position, he lifted it carefully from the sand and kicked his way to the surface to show his startled colleagues. Over the following six summer diving seasons, the team slowly teased more secrets out of the wreck. They have so far recovered a total of 4 belt sets, ornamental buckles with matching belt strap ends, all in gold, plus a golden buckle encrusted with rubies, or emeralds, and pearls, the likes of which, Mihaljek says, have never been found anywhere. They also catalog the golden imperial signet ring and 14 solidi, chunky gold coins, with Constantinople mint marks. Shipwrecks are time capsules, snapshots of life precisely as it was on a particular day. And in addition to the glittering assortment of jewelry and coins, the team recovered a mountain of less eye-catching artifacts. Millstones, crockery, fishing tackle, even dice and game pieces used for backgammon or checkers. All parts of a puzzle that, with time and much research, will be used by archaeologists to tease out an untold story from an obscure past. Of the ship itself, little remains, just a few waterlogged remnants of its keel, ribs, and planking. But there was enough for Mihaljek and team to surmise it was a fairly standard mid-sized cargo ship of the time, about 60 feet long, with a capacity of around 60 tons. Judging by the dates on the coins, the types of amphorae, and the workmanship of the jewelry, researchers have refined the dating of the wreck to the first half of the 8th century. Its location, on the southeastern approach to the harbor of Polace, indicates it was probably sailing north, up the Adriatic, when disaster struck. Mihaljek thinks the jewelry and gold belonged to someone wealthy and well-connected aboard the ship, which probably started its fateful voyage in Constantinople, and may have been heading for Ravenna, some 300 miles away. Another clue to ponder. The number of amphorae found in the wreck, about 100, was only a fraction of what archaeologists would normally expect to find on a ship that size, indicating that something other than bulk cargo was funding the expedition. The dawn of the 8th century was a troubled time in the history of one of the world's great empires. Constantinople, the Byzantine capital, was dedicated in 330 and endured for over 1,000 years until it was overrun by the Ottoman Turks in 1453. Its inhabitants didn't think of themselves as Byzantines, but as Romans, considering the empire a continuation of ancient Rome. During the centuries following the fall of Rome in 476, the fortunes of the Byzantine Empire ebbed and flowed before rising to a brief golden age under the Emperor Basil II in the 11th century. The latter half of the 7th century was one of the gloomier times. The previous 100 years were characterized by plague, famine, and long destructive wars against the Persians, leaving the Byzantine Empire in no state to resist the astonishingly swift rise of Islam, whose seemingly unstoppable armies had seized vast territories in the Middle East. Asia and North Africa, after the Prophet Muhammad's death in 632, the fortunes of the Byzantine Empire were still at a low ebb around 700, at which time the empire had been stripped of its richest provinces by the all-conquering Arabs to the south. Its great seaborne trading days, when wine produced in the Byzantine province of Gaza could be purchased in Britain and the harbor of Theodosius in Constantinople bustled with ships carrying grain from Egypt, seemed to be over for good. The Adriatic virtually disappears from the written record between the 7th and 8th centuries, with little mention of travel or trade on its waters in Latin or Greek. Quote, "It's a blank," end quote, says Francesco Borri, a medieval scholar and associate professor of humanities at the Ca' Foscari University of Venice, who suspects that far more was going on in real life than written records imply. Quote, "That's why the discovery of this ship is so exciting," end quote. One possibility is that the ship was on a diplomatic mission, bearing gifts of these lavishly decorated belt sets for parties along the Adriatic they hoped to keep friendly to the Byzantine cause. Quote, "You can see a clear stylistic connection between the Byzantine Empire and the Avar Empire," end quote, says Falco Daim, professor of early medieval archaeology at the University of Vienna and scholar of Byzantine-era belt sets. Quote, "One of the sets from the shipwreck is identical to a set found in Avar grave that I purchased for the Romish Germanicis Central Museum in Mainz when I was a director there. The two sets are so similar, they had to have been made in the same workshop," end quote. The sets, some of which were antiques even at the time of the voyage, appear to have been a collection. Quote, "Their dates span almost the entirety of the 7th century," end quote, Daim says. Quote, "This is very unusual and makes it difficult to interpret historically," end quote. The newest of them, the one with the birds and grapes motif, dates roughly to the early 8th century, not long before the time of the ship's sinking. The styling is also distinctly Byzantine. Quote, "The Avar seldom used birds as motifs, and when they did use them, it was generally an eagle," end quote, he says. Quote, "But the Byzantines loved birds," end quote. It's possible, Daim says, that this belt set was the personal property of the ship's owner. Such gilded accessories were a common way to curry favor in this part of the world. Quote, "Golden belt sets, even the signet ring of Heraclius, are precisely the sorts of gifts a Byzantine emperor would present," end quote, says Peter Saris, professor of Byzantine studies at Cambridge University. One recipient of such elegance was a prince named Junaser, who ruled Caucasian Albania in the mid-7th century. To secure the prince's loyalties, Byzantine Emperor Constans II gave him a swag of ornate accessories, including a belt buckle set that had once belonged to Constans' grandfather, Emperor Heraclius. It, quote, "would have been a much prized gift," end quote, Saris says. Quote, "Anything associated with Heraclius was especially highly regarded," end quote. A signet ring from the emperor would be even grander. Quote, "It would be like the British government today giving Winston Churchill's pocket watch to the leader of a country with which they wanted to stay on good terms," end quote, he says. Complicating the narrative around the older belt sets is the fact that Mihaljek and his team also found goldsmithing equipment in the ship's wreckage. Scales, weights, crucibles, and pools of mercury, an element used by smiths to extract gold from alloys. Quote, "With these simple old-fashioned pieces, meant to be melted down and turned into newer, more modern styles? End quote. Diane asks. Was someone on board planning to sell these items or traveling as some sort of emissary? Quote, we have to use our imaginations, end quote, he says. It's this storytelling potential that intrigues the archaeologist far more than the glint of gold. Until Miljek and his team found the belt sets off of Miljek, such objects had been known almost exclusively from grave sites. Quote, we simply do not have much evidence of these things on the move, just their eventual deposition, end quote, says Justin Liedwanger, associate professor of archaeology and classics at Stanford University. Liedwanger is keen to investigate the economic connections that entangle the empire at the time. Quote, to my mind, this is the most important shipwreck of the period, end quote, he says. Preliminary studies of the amphorae found with the wreck suggest the ship may have been traveled far more extensively around the eastern Mediterranean than historians might have assumed. Quote, we're finding connections with southern Italy and northern Africa, end quote, Liedwanger says. Quote, this raises interesting questions. Were the people from Byzantium still trading directly with North Africa even after the Islamic conquest? End quote. Much of the surviving text from the 7th century was written by clergy. Quote, between the rise of Islam and the decline of the empire, they tended to take a bleak view of the times, end quote, Liedwanger says. Quote, we are left with all these descriptions of sacked and abandoned cities, end quote. Yet, as scholars have found in Western Europe after the fall of Rome, there was still culture, as well as commerce. Quote, the Dark Ages weren't really all that dark, end quote, he says. More research remains to be done on the artifacts that Miljek and his team have brought up from the seafloor. But the idea that sometime around 750, a Byzantine cargo ship could have been sailing north on a diplomatic mission, perhaps bearing gifts for an influential ally, is certainly a new historical theory to ponder. And the details surrounding such a voyage, how the trip could have taken months, how the crew probably passed the time doing mundane things like fishing and playing backgammon, all help humanize the stakes and drive home the emissary's ambition. The researchers recently shared plans to return to the site this summer to see what else they might uncover. Quote, finding all these artifacts brings mixed emotions, end quote, archaeologist Duganjic says. Quote, feelings of awe and respect for the passengers and crew, who obviously ended their journey on the rocky shores of Miljek, and the pleasure of being able to tell their story, end quote. A story that would otherwise have been lost forever. The end. This is Paul, and I'll be reading from the National Geographic Magazine, April 2026, from the section Hidden History, the title, Your Chia Pet's Roots Are Deeper Than You Think. Long before the campy ceramic planters were all over TikTok, or even 80s TV airwaves, they served as Mexican ceremonial artifacts with a different wow factor. By Sam Keen. If you were alive and channel surfing in the 80s and 90s, you almost certainly remember the jingle, Chia. Today, some 50 years since Chia Pets first hit shelves in the United States, the funny little planters are still going strong. Available early on in a menagerie of cutesy animal shapes, including sheep, turtles, kittens, and teddy bears, The brand hit the pop culture stratosphere with that all-time catchy ditty, then branched out into licensed characters, think Bugs Bunny and Bart Simpson, in the early 2000s. And while the growing process is unchanged, soak the porous clay figurine in water, spread on a paste of seeds, and watch the sprouts cover your, quote, pet, end quote, in fuzzy greenery. Chia pets have since caught on with a whole new generation, thanks to retro nostalgia, time-lapse TikTok videos, and an increasingly vast and mimified catalog. Yes, you can still buy a chia kitten, but it's in the mix with a chia poop emoji, a chia wrapper ice spice, and a complete set of chia golden girls. 5 decades on, the quiche still connects. But when Marta Turok, a Mexican anthropologist specializing in folk art, looks at a chia pet, she sees more than a gag gift or droll decor. Her first time encountering one was at a Woolworth department store in Mexico City in the early 1990s. On the box was a clay bear with sprouted green fur that she recognized right away as a nod to the regional religious handicraft, one she had no idea had been co-opted into a novelty knick-knack. Quote, "I thought it was crazy," end quote, Turok says, quote, "that somebody saw this as fun for kids," end quote. As Turok knows, the much overlooked roots of the chia pet are anything but frivolous. In the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca, terracotta animals covered in chia spouts are a mainstay of the elaborate Semana Santa altars found in homes and churches in the lead-up to Easter. The Holy Week altars are solemn affairs, set with candles, flowers, and other decorations that typically flank a weeping likeness of La Virgen Desoladoras, a Lady of Sorrows. To the faithful, the figurines are highly symbolic, says Seattle-based ceramic artist Raul Aguila, who is originally from Oaxaca's neighboring state of Chiapas, and has written about the tradition's significance. The green chia shoots evoke the, quote, "continuum, the continuation of life," end quote, Aguila says, in anticipation of Christ's Easter Day resurrection. And the choice of animal can have meaning, too. Sheep suggests the Lamb of God, while roosters call to mind the biblical story of the Apostle Peter denying Jesus before a cock crowed the dawn. Bulls, goats, dogs, and deer, and even elephants are all creatures one might spot on an altar these days. To make them, artisans start with a mold and a lump of moist clay, create a hollow shell of a generic animal body, then add specific features like legs, horns, and antlers. After the figures have dried to a leathery consistency, they're scored with a stylus, or say, a comb or fork, to make grooves where the seeds can settle and sprouts can anchor. After an initial firing in a kiln, the animal's heads are glazed with a dark green lacquer, then fired a second time to fuse the glaze. To Aguila, the Semana Santa pieces are a powerful example of syncretism, the blending of different religious traditions to produce something new. It's a historical irony that the grain-like seeds of Salvia hispanica, or chia, play a central role in a Catholic custom. The Spanish once banned the plant's cultivation because of its ties to an indigenous religion. Chia seeds were a staple for many native Mexicans, who pressed them for medicinal oil and ground them into flour for food. Aztec emperors received them by the ton as tribute from conquered lands, while warriors drank a sort of pre-battle energy shake made of chia flour mixed with water and agave syrup. Chia, in fact, likely gives the state of Chiapas its name, deriving from a word in Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs, that describes a place where the plant grows. But for all that history and symbolism, Aguirre suggests that there's still a playful side to the little animals. Quote, "They're trying to cheer Mary up," end quote, he says. Quote, "They're adorable. They're saying, don't cry," end quote. The adorableness caught the eye of the late American marketer, Joseph Pidot, back in 1977, when a drugstore sales rep first showed him an imported OxyContin chia figurine. Pidot thought he could sell them in droves, so he snatched up the rights and went to Mexico to study the production process. The company he founded, which shifted production to China in 1989, says that to date it has sold more than 32 million chia pets in 11 countries. This includes one to Mata Turok at that Mexico City Woolworth more than 30 years ago. Despite the bear pictured on the box, she found a turtle inside when she opened it at home. She still has it today, although she's never sprouted the seeds. She only bought it, Turok says, to teach her son about the unexpected ways that traditional products can transform for modern times. The end. This is Paul, and I'll be reading from National Geographic Magazine, April 2026. In the section entitled Journeys, an article titled, "How National Parkgoers Learn to Love Modernist Architecture." Mid-century planners in the U.S. Park Service ditched rustic timbers for clean lines in concrete. Now their creation has gone from eyesores to icons. By Catherine O'Shea Evans. A tourist in the national parks in 1956 might have had a hard time ignoring that America's crown jewels were in a pickle. Visitation had more than doubled in the prosperous decades since the end of World War II, and the parks were unready for the surge. More than 50 million people passed through the entrance stations that summer, many arriving in big cars of post-war make, often pulling onto roads designed in the era of the Model T. Staffing shortages were rampant, and maintenance issues plagued the few rustic buildings that offered visitor services. So to the rescue, the flailing parks, the National Park Service, NPS, launched a 10-year, billion-dollar effort to modernize them. It was dubbed Mission 66, as in revamp the visitor experience by 1966, the 50th anniversary of the Park Service. The plan championed access and convenience, making it easier for millions to take in some of the United States' most extraordinary scenery, but it wasn't until decades later that their purpose-built structures at the heart of the scheme became scenic attractions themselves. The Mission 66 program saw the construction of centralized hospitality villages, what the NPS director at the time called, quote, "zones of civilization in a wilderness setting," end quote. It introduced the then novel concept of the visitor center, borrowing ideas from the shopping centers springing up around the burgeoning suburbs. And it brought mid-century modern architecture to a park system where most buildings fell on a spectrum between ramshackle hunting cabins and Bavarian chalets. The new buildings, which went up by the hundreds, weren't necessarily intended to be showstoppers. Plenty were bland and functional ranger stations, admin buildings, or staff housing. Others were architect-designed specimens of Jetsons-esque flair or brutalist gravity. And right from the beginning, and for decades to come, they were debated, derided, and dismissed. Quote, "ugly beyond words to describe," end quote, wrote the traditionalist editor of National Parks magazine, critiquing one building in an anti-modernism screed from the 1950s. Quote, "some regrettable architectural legacies," end quote, summed up a historian in 1997, at a time when calls to dismantle Mission 66 buildings were becoming commonplace. But more recently, defenders of Mission 66 architecture say they've seen a shift. What was once viewed as egregiously contemporary, out of step with the lodge-like style known as pocketeer, now strikes visitors as nostalgic, says Ethan Carr, a professor of landscape architecture at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of 2007's Mission 66, Modernism and the National Park Dilemma. Quote, "I don't see Mission 66 as being threatened the way it was when I wrote that book," end quote, Carr says. In the years since, he suggests, Americans have stopped associating modernistic architecture with the problems of modernity, like travel and overcrowding. Quote, "nowadays," end quote, Carr says wryly, quote, "the whole American landscape is so devastated that people look at modernistic architecture and think it's quaint," end quote. It's a sea change from the architectural historian Christine Madrid French worked for the Park Service 30 years ago. Quote, "at that point, most of these buildings built between 56 and 66 were not considered historic," end quote, says French, today the executive director of California's Napa County Landmarks. Many were overdue for repairs, and the way they'd been sited, right alongside natural and historic resources, had come to be viewed as intrusive. Mission 66 buildings, French says, quote, "were at a critical juncture. Are they going to survive or not?" end quote. Some did not. A spate of demolitions in the 2000s, including the Quarry Visitor Center at Utah's Dinosaur National Monument, a squat concrete cylinder, and the Henry M. Jackson Memorial, formerly Paradise Visitor Center at Washington's Mount Rainier National Park, often compared to a flying saucer. The turning point, French says, came in 2013, with the leveling of the drum-shaped concrete and glass cyclorama visitor center at Gettysburg National Military Park. Designed by celebrated modernist Richard Neutra, it was dedicated in 1962 atop the site of Pickett's Charge. When the NPS decided visitors would be better served with a hillside restored to a pastoral state, French led a legal and public relations effort to save the cyclorama, ultimately to no avail. Its loss, however, seemed to kick off a reassessment of other Mission 66 structures. The next year, the Neutra-designed Painted Desert Community Complex at Arizona's Petrified Forest National Park, itself briefly slated to be razed in the 1990s, was named a national treasure by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. a collection of low-slung glass and stucco buildings. It became a National Historic Landmark in 2017. Quote, after the cyclorama, there was a change, end quote, French says. Quote, people said, you know what? Let's look at these buildings again, end quote. The era's design prestige has only snowballed since. And these days, when NPS deems a modernistic park building is no longer meeting visitor needs, the conversation is often about adaptive reuse rather than demolition. Mid-century modern is the whole motif at Yellowstone's Canyon Lodge, part of the first Mission 66 project to break ground back in 1956. Adapted beyond recognizability over the years, the lodge has since been restored to its Eisenhower-era glory, down to the starburst chandeliers. Of course, Mission 66 was never about aesthetics. The goal was a wholesale reimagining of how America's parks would work in an era of auto tourism. Its planners and architects, quote, were really interested in this very specific visitor experience, end quote, says preservation consultant Becky Zeller, whose Columbia University master's thesis surveyed the state of the era's visitor centers. The intent has sometimes been muddled by retrofits, Zeller says, gift shops and snack bars cluttering the intended flow. But she praises the elegance of the building's original purpose, guiding parkgoers through an almost choreographed routine of parking, welcome, and interpretation, culminating in an appeal, quote, to go out and explore the resource, end quote. That final flourish was often a grand set of windows framing a park tableau, an invitation to leave the visitor center behind. The end. This is Paul, and I'll be reading from the National Geographic Magazine, April 2026, an article entitled Living History. At the glittering new National History Museum, Abu Dhabi, curators want to bring visitors astonishingly close to the most fascinating creatures the Earth has ever seen. Doing so required dreaming up and then bringing to life one of the most ambitious museums ever attempted. Dinosaurs are winging in at 550 miles an hour from across the planet. Diplodocus, Stegosaurus, a herd of Triceratops, and a pair of Tyrannosaurus rex, plus a carcass for the Tyrannosaurus to combat over. The museum has them in a queue, along with thousands of other specimens, from a fog-basking beetle to a reconstructed dodo. Some of them are awaiting takeoff. Some are in flight. Others are being uncrated, condition-checked, 3D-scanned, and quickly moved out for reassembly on the museum floor, all to make room for the next specimens just rolling through the delivery bay door. It's early November 2025, and there are 20 days left until the opening of the National History Museum's Abu Dhabi, NHMAD, a 377,000-square-foot structure being built and populated on what even the museum managers admit is an, quote, insanely short, end quote, five-year timeline. With luck, the final major specimen, the last of five 75-foot-tall sauropods greeting visitors at the entrance, will arrive in time to go on display a day or two before the soft opening. That's when Abu Dhabi's royal families will arrive, fully expecting to be impressed. At the moment, however, that dinosaur, Diplodocus, is still in Canada, and the mount is not yet complete. No pressure, though. The new museum stands on a sandy, low-lying island named Saadiyat, separated by an inlet off the Persian Gulf from the metropolitan Abu Dhabi, the capital city of the United Arab Emirates, UAE. Nearby in the neighborhood, the Louvre Abu Dhabi, opened in 2017, plus the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi and a new national museum, both rushing to completion at the same time as the National History Museum. Much of the rest of the island is also under construction, with high-end hotels and housing for the crowds all these vaunted institutions are expected to attract. Name brands, celebrated architects, and superlatives clearly matter. Ride a hotel elevator in town, and a 30-second film on loop remind you that Yas Island, Abu Dhabi's entertainment counterpart to Saadiyat, boasts a Formula One racetrack, the world's fastest roller coaster, in a Ferrari World theme park, and the, quote, world's largest indoor skydiving flight chamber, end quote. It's all part of a well-financed push to transform Abu Dhabi from a sandy desert patrol state into a travel destination and a cultural heavyweight on a par with Paris and London, or rather, ahead of Paris and London, if Abu Dhabi achieves its declared goal of attracting 39.3 million visitors a year by 2030, up from 6.6 million in 2025. That doesn't mean the UAE is backing away from its chief business of gas and oil exports. The opposite, in fact. The heavy spending to promote tourism and other industries marks a deliberate shift away from dependence on fossil fuels, which now account for just 30% of the national economy, down from 85% as recently as 2009. The Natural History Museum will be the first of its scale in the Middle East. The people planning it mean to acquire, quote, some of the most incredible specimens known to mankind, end quote. Like a chunk of the Murchison meteorite containing grains of a universe from before our sun existed, or fossils of a miniature horse that once wandered Abu Dhabi itself. They also want to reveal those specimens in ways that bring the public much closer to the natural world than other globally renowned museums have dared. Driving that ambition is a man the museum staff refers to as, quote, the chairman, end quote. Mohammed Khalifa A. Mubarak, who heads the Department of Culture and Tourism and various other entities, including the company supervising construction of the museum. He manages to visit almost daily, quote, he's everywhere every day, end quote, says a construction manager who has experienced the chairman's leadership at Yas Island, the Louvre, and other projects. Quote, he doesn't sleep, I think, end quote, as a museum administrator. The changes he makes ripple through the building. Less than 3 weeks before opening, for instance, he orders the removal of dozens of visitor information stations on the grounds that they crowd the aisles, can be read only by able-bodied adults, and come between people and the exhibits. The cables that powered them now snag up the floor to nowhere. Now snake up the floor to nowhere. They'll be gone, too, before long. The hope, says Al-Mubarak, in English Americanized by his college years in Boston, is that every child who visits will come away thinking, quote, I gotta do everything in my power to safeguard what's here right now. Whether it's the ocean, the deserts, the beautiful trees, I need to safeguard this. I need to safeguard every single species, end quote. The museum, he says, will be a place, quote, to look into a better future for our natural world, end quote. Maybe one day soon. But right now, 20 days out, time is short, and the Diplodocus isn't the only thing missing from the museum floor. The clock for the Abu Dhabi Natural History Museum started ticking on October 6, 2020, in a Manhattan auction room emptied by the COVID pandemic. When the final lot of the evening, the celebrated Tyrannosaurus Rex fossil, dubbed Stan, came under the hammer, a 20-minute bidding war ensued, culminating in a winning offer, auction fees and all, of $31.8 million. It was then the highest price ever paid for a dinosaur. Outraged paleontologists worried in news accounts that Stan would be lost to science in some billionaire's private collection, and that museums were being priced out of the market. In fact, the anonymous buyer was Abu Dhabi. By the inexorable logic of the five-year plan, that start put the opening of the Natural History Museum sometimes in the late quarter of 2025. In Abu Dhabi, as a member of the museum staff later tells me, people often, quote, want things to happen fast, to be high impact, to make a statement, end quote. To make it happen, Abu Dhabi turned to the woman who had just completed a major updating of the National Museum of Ireland. Judith McAllister signed on as an employee number one in 2021 with the job of choreographing construction, finance, hiring, acquisitions, and whatever else came up, all happening in parallel and compressed into 4 years, then left to opening day. As project manager, McAllister brought a kind of contagious delight to the making of a new museum, rather than, say, sheer terror. She's, quote, the beating heart of the museum, end quote, says Philip Manning, who advised the team from the start in between classes at the University of Manchester before becoming the museum's full-time science director in 2024. McAllister, Manning notes, is also, quote, a blur, end quote, for the speed at which she made the choreography happen. Money wasn't an issue for the museum in the ways that are normal in the natural history world. Quote, in Europe, they give you 25 euros and say, quote, go make an exhibit, end quote, one staff member jokes. Quote, oh, but there's overhead, so they take back 40%, end quote. Soon after Abu Dhabi's Stan bid became known, though, fossil dealers began, quote, adding zeros, end quote, onto their prices, says McAllister. The museum was being, quote, offered things for insane amounts of money that every other place in the world would be offered for a fraction of the price, end quote. She was outraged, and, quote, not just about the money here, end quote. By then, the museum team recognized that it shouldn't be driving up global prices and pricing out other museums. Quote, so yeah, there's been a lot of negotiations, hard negotiation, where I've fallen out, end quote, with dealers for a time, McAllister says. Based on advice from Manning and others well-connected in the fossil world, McAllister began buying directly from people at excavation sites. Quote, they have all of the backstory, end quote, she says. Buying straight from the dig made due diligence easier. The aim was to avoid the, quote, colonial plunder, end quote, at the heart of many past museum collections, as well as specimens with tangled ownership histories. Quote, you want to open right, end quote, says McAllister. Quote, and make sure that the museum is clean and can be a trusted museum in that sense, end quote. At one point, the museum was offered an Archaeopteryx, one of only 14 known specimens of the celebrated Jurassic bird. It was the acquisition of a lifetime, except for the tangled ownership history. Quote, the paperwork was little to nothing. Various letters from one German person to another saying, my friend is la la la, quote, end quote, says McAllister. Quote, we had to say no. It's just too risky for us, end quote. Mention of the Archaeopteryx still brings forlorn yearning to faces around the museum. Another deal, for a collection of extraordinarily preserved ichthyosaurs, ammonites, and other Jurassic fossils from Holzmaden in southern Germany, also fell apart on paperwork issues and negotiations with a dealer. More forlorn faces. Later, though, it came back on the market being sold by the original owners, quote, which takes out such a huge layer of problems, end quote, she says. Quote, so it is actually arriving next Monday, end quote. That would be 15 days to opening, with 25 enormous crates coming through the shipping by bay door. Quote, that's a big, big celebration for us, because we thought we'd lost it, end quote. To be completed at my next reading.